Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Tuneo Akaha, Professor of International Policy Studies and Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He'll speak on the topic Old and New Conflicts, Japan and the Great Powers. Mr. Akaha's appearance was co-sponsored by Creighton University's Asian World Center, the Werner Institute for Negotiation and Dispute Resolution, and the Department of Political Science and International Relations in the College of Arts and Sciences. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Graham Ramsden, Chairman of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Creighton University.
Our speaker today is Dr. Tuneo Akaha. He is currently on sabbatical and serving as a visiting professor at Waseda University in Tokyo. Dr. Akaha received his MA and PhD in International Relations from the University of Southern California and his BAs in Political Science from Oregon State University and Waseda University. So with that, I'd like to bring up our distinguished guest. Dr. Tuneo Akaha.
Should I speak here or there? It's indeed my pleasure and honor to be able to share my thoughts about old and new conflicts in Asia and my humble suggestions as to how we might begin to address them and then hopefully solve some of them at least. What I'm going to do today is to give a very brief overview of what I consider to be what is called critical junctures, major events and developments in the history of East Asia in the modern times, such that they have lasting impact even to this day, both opportunities and conflicts, to start with. And then other regional developments in East Asia of more recent origin that have structural impacts and constraints and opportunities for East Asian communities to relate to each other, some of which are not doing too well, as you will come to realize as I go through my presentation. And then developments inside Japan, which happens to be my home country, because I think Japan continues to hold a lot of potential to play an extremely important role in resolving some of the issues, some of the problems, some of the conflicts in East Asia. But so far, for various reasons, has been prevented from doing so. And I have some ideas as to how to begin to do that. I'm not running for prime ministership. Don't worry. I just have some suggestions for anybody in the audience who has access to the prime minister to convey to him. Even though he's a graduate of Waseda University, Mr. Inoda, I was earlier mentioning to some people that I was talking to some professors at Waseda University, asking them if they remember him, and they didn't. So that meant either he was such a bad student, he never came to school, or he had nothing to offer, nothing to contribute to class discussions, or he was busy preparing himself for a political career. Either way, he was very successful, indeed. Now, going back to critical junctures in East Asia, which played and continue to play a major role in shaping some conflictual relationships among East Asian countries and some opportunities to bridge the gaps. I would start saying Western imperialism and Japanese emulation of Western imperialism, turning it into Japanese militarism in the 19th and the 20th century. I would call that probably one of the most important, one of the most fundamentally important critical junctures in East Asia. And this gave rise to nationalism, which took over and prevailed over a very nascent internationalism that did exist in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. Then the Second World War, you would all agree, was another critical juncture, leaving lasting legacy in the form of nationalism that tends to see others as hostile towards them. I'm speaking of China, I'm speaking Korea, I'm speaking Japan. And also leading to territorial disputes, jurisdictional disputes, issues of history over which Japan has not really been able to overcome disagreements, major disagreements with its neighboring countries. And then the Cold War came. The East-West division of East Asia basically prevented reconciliation between the Japanese and the Chinese and the Koreans. On the one hand, the Japanese people, most of them, are very appreciative of the assistance that the United States provided for Japan's economic recovery, political revitalization, democratization, and returning to the civilized world. On the other hand, it did have a lasting impact of not allowing the Japanese to come face-to-face with the Chinese in reaching the kind of reconciliation that the Germans and the French were able to do, because they happened to be on the same side of the ideological conflict called the Cold War. Then we still have the lasting effect of the Cold War in the form of divided nations, China and Korea. The United States played a central role in providing order, stability to the Western camp in East Asia by developing bilateral security alliances with Japan, with South Korea, and the United States also tried to develop something similar to NATO in Southeast Asia, known as CETO. But that did not come into fruition. So we have what is called the hub and spokes alliance system centered around the United States, and that continues to this day. And the Cold War also had its own impact on the historical views of each other among East Asian communities. Selective memories exist not only in Japan, in terms of Japan's historical experience, highlighting the achievements and downplaying the atrocities that it committed upon their neighboring countries. Selective memory also exists in China. As I may not really have to reveal everything that we know about what happened during the Great Cultural Revolution, Great Leap Forward, the Tiananmen Massacre, and so on and so forth. But selective memory is part and parcel of national identity formation, which is dictated or at least managed or controlled by the central government in each of the East Asian countries. So I would say that is a lasting effect of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War was just as important as the Cold War itself, except for the fact that remnants of Cold War, as I mentioned earlier, divided nations, are still present in East Asia. Nonetheless, the end of the Cold War brought about a measure of improvement in China-Japan relations, Japan-Russia relations, South Korea-China relations, and South Korea-Russia relations. When the Cold War came to an end, many scholars in East Asia, not just Chinese but Japanese and also South Korean scholars, began to wonder if the U.S. strategic presence in East Asia was no longer necessary, or whether or not the United States would be able to justify its continued military presence in East Asia in terms of other security needs, not only of the United States, but also of the countries in the region, going beyond the ideological conflict between the East and the West. In the initial phases of the post-war period, the United States seemed to show reluctance to embrace multilateralism, preferring rather bilateral approaches to political and security relationships in the region. And then 9/11 came along, and I would put that as one of the major events of the recent past that really had a major, major impact on the relationships among East Asian countries. First, we began to talk about fighting a war against terrorism. But if we are fighting a war at all, it's an entirely different kind of war than the First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War, Vietnamese War, and even the Cold War. Because the enemy is invisible most of the time. Enemy could be among us. I don't mean in this room, of course, obviously. And the enemy has the kind of weapons that are fairly easily accessible, including miniaturized weapons of mass destruction, chemical biological warfare, that could be harnessed by a few individuals that have the technique and that are well-financed by their sponsors. So we're talking about a very individualized access to these kinds of destructive weapons that could trigger a whole series of massive-scale disasters. And this requires cooperation of the kind that is unprecedented. It involves individual citizens, organizations, groups, national governments, transnational organizations, and of course the international organizations, such as the United Nations. And East Asian countries are struggling as to how best to curtail the potential of terrorism, not only from beyond their borders, but from within their borders. Japan, for example, has experienced its own homemade terrorist organizations and groups. China, according to the Chinese government at least, independence movement in Xinjiang occasionally resorts to terrorist tactics. Therefore, the Chinese government would like to cooperate with the United States, with Russia and other countries, Central Asian republics, to curtail and to contain the potential terrorist threat from that part of China. Russia, for its own reasons, also has sources of domestic terrorism, as the Russian government defines them. So, different countries have different threat perceptions, and they do need to cooperate in terms of exchanging information, curtailing and eliminating transfers of funds, information, people flows. So there's clearly a strategic need for these countries to cooperate. But given the historical legacy of not trusting each other, the East Asian countries are finding it extremely difficult even to deal with this common concern known as international terrorism. Some other regional developments which have had lasting structural impacts in the region would include, first and foremost, China's rise. As you know, China surpassed Japan in terms of GDP for the first time last year. For the first time in history of the world, China and Japan are now more or less on an equal footing. Unprecedented. China doesn't know how to deal with Japan on an equal footing. Japan doesn't know how to deal with China as an equal partner. So it requires a psychological leap from the past experience into the present and the future when these two countries will continue, will begin to form a structure, international relations of East Asia. And of course, the United States plays a very prominent role in this. And how Japan relates to China is in part a function of how the relationship between Washington, D.C. and Beijing, how that relationship evolves. So this trilateral relationship has a tremendous structural impact in all of the East Asian countries. Sustained economic growth inside China is a source of stability and source of legitimacy for the government. It's no longer communism as an ideology that justifies the one-party dictatorship in Beijing. It is the economic growth and the sharing the prosperity of that growth with the masses of people. But given the size of the country, given the size of the population, and given the diversity of the communities in China, it's extremely difficult to share that newly acquired wealth equally among all the people, which, after all, is anathema to the ideals and ideas of communism. So there's a tremendous social pressure which could turn into a political unrest throughout the country that would destabilize China. And that will be against the interest not only of the Chinese government, but also of the neighboring countries, including my own country, Japan. So how China will proceed with its path towards even a greater status of economic power has very, very important implications for all of us. China also occasionally uses nationalist sentiment among its population to divert domestic attention away from the internal ills and woes and problems. one incident that took place back in September 2010 around the so-called Senkaku Island, or Tiayu Island, in the East China Sea, is a case in point. One Chinese trawler rammed up against two Japanese Coast Guard vessels in an area contested by both countries as their territorial waters. In the end, to make the long story short, the Japanese government, under pressure, international pressure, but primarily from China, released the skipper of the trawler. And immediately, a public opinion poll indicated that 80% of the public in Japan were against that release. But the government came to the determination that even though this was a violation of Japanese territorial claims, that Japan did not want to risk damaging its bilateral political relationship with China unnecessarily. So it was, I think, a smart decision, but in the eyes of the public, it was not well accepted at all. So it's this kind of nationalism, nationalist sentiment that has to be balanced with diplomatic political relationships, interests with respect to stable bilateral relationship between Japan and China that the Japanese government must always be mindful of. And I suspect the same logic applies to the Chinese government. And nuclear missile development in North Korea is also another issue that has a tremendous impact on the character of and relationship and nature of relationship and among East Asian countries. I've been looking in great detail at how each of the countries has tried to manage its national interests involved in the North Korean case. There's one commonality among all the participants in the so-called six-party talks, with the exception perhaps of North Korea, which is to denuclearize North Korea. But beyond that fundamental common interest, the strategic political interests of all the countries diverge in different directions. And there is no common vision beyond North Korea nuclear crisis, which makes it very difficult to define and identify a common strategy leading to the objective of denuclearizing North Korea. Because in the process of inducing North Korea to give up its weapons, missiles and nuclear weapons and material and technology, you might advantage other countries in the region and disadvantage yourself. For example, if North Korea decides to surrender its nuclear weapons and missile technology, thanks to the Chinese support for their existing regime, would the United States welcome that? The United States would welcome the part about the denuclearization of North Korea. But China, expanding its political, economic, and perhaps even social influence into North Korea, is probably not something that the United States would welcome, nor would South Korean government or people welcome Chinese exerting its influence over the northern half of the Korean Peninsula. Because it might, among other things, make it very difficult for the South Koreans and the North Koreans to reconcile their differences and become reunited again as a nation. Another event that has taken place recently of tremendous importance is the Asian financial crisis of 1997-98. The booming economies of Southeast Asia hit a very hard rock called the financial crisis, and some of the economic performance really plummeted, leading eventually to the ousting of government in Indonesia, and even involving some violence in that country. Here in the United States, tended to look at the financial crisis as a result not of any international finance, but of the way the finance was handled or mishandled or mismanaged internally within Southeast Asian economies and later on in Northeast Asian economies as well. Whereas the economies and analysts in those countries tended to blame the international capital that would come in one day and then pick up a leave the next day according to its own logic of financial interests. So when Japan proposed what is known as the Japanese finance minister's proposal for the pooling of currencies from within East Asia that could be drawn upon in case something similar happens the next time. But the United States was opposed to this idea, thinking the dollar would be replaced by a pooling of local currencies for stabilizing the economic fortunes in the East Asian economies. And in the end, however, the Asian countries did decide to have their own currency swap arrangement known as the Chiang Mai Initiative, which is not a huge sum of money, but nonetheless it symbolizes the fact that Asian countries are now beginning to organize their own resources, mobilize their own resources to help them go over some economic hurdles in the future. This sort of symbolizes the perception, at least, if not the reality, of the relative decline of the U.S. presence in East Asia. Now, some people in Asia welcome this. Other people are very nervous that the United States might be reducing its presence in East Asia. Japan was pretty much split among the intellectual community as to whether to welcome this sign of declining U.S. influence presence in East Asia or whether to be concerned because China was on the rise and Chinese influence will eventually overtake Japanese economy in terms of East Asian regional influence, because Japanese economy has been in doldrums since its economic bubble burst in the early 1990s. There is a currency swap, as I said, known as the Chiang Mai Initiative, and this will be a good test to see whether or not the Asian economies will be able to develop a regional framework that will be under their control without the United States or the IMF extending its hands of assistance to overcome future financial crises. I mean, nobody wants a future financial crisis, but if it does come, to what extent is this new initiative going to be effective in containing the contagious, debilitating effects of a financial crisis of the magnitude that we faced in 1997-98. Even though, as I said, East Asian countries have pulled together their financial resources, there is a competition between China and Japan as to who would put up the most share of that pool of currencies. They agreed to equalize their share for now. There was a tit-for-tat offers being made, which was to the liking of the Southeast Asian countries because they got the best bargain from both sides. But it does indicate that Japan and China, both interested in some kind of a leadership role in the region, nonetheless compete against each other. Another development, not necessarily not something that has an immediate shock effect, but a profound effect nonetheless, is the economic integration in East Asia. Now, for the first time, most of the East Asian countries trade more extensively within the region than with countries outside, including the United States. This is a fairly recent phenomenon. I'm not pretending to say that there is going to be an East Asian economy bloc closed to outsiders, or the kind of yen bloc that emerged, before the Second World War, But it is clear that the network of production, markets, labor that crisscross national borders in East Asia have really brought these countries and economies into closer integrated format. So the United States will have a tough time breaking into that region in terms of market access unless the United States becomes part of some institutionalized mechanisms for further deeper integration in East Asia. And the United States has proposed that Japan join such a framework known as TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, in Japan, there has been a very heated political debate as to whether Japan should really even join to discuss this new initiative. Because China clearly does not appreciate the United States taking a leadership role in instituting a different framework than the existing framework known as bilateral or multilateral FTAs, free trade agreements. There are several institutions in East Asia that have begun to show us that East Asian countries do have genuine regional identities being developed and that they would like to work with each other to form regional institutions and frameworks for dealing with their common problems. One such institution is known as ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN Plus 3, the three being China, Japan, and Republic of Korea, that regularly meet to discuss economic and some political issues. And then ASEAN Plus 6, six includes those three countries, China, Japan, and South Korea, and also Australia, New Zealand, and India. Now, China prefers ASEAN Plus 3. Japan prefers ASEAN Plus 6 because they want New Zealand, India, and Australia to be part of this group so as to diffuse the otherwise potentially dominant influence of China. China does not want the United States to become part of this particular series of frameworks. So as I said earlier, the United States has initiated a major drive towards the formation of a TPP, as I said earlier. Also, there is an East Asia Summit that has grown over the last 3 years. For the first time this weekend, the United States will participate in this East Asia Summit along with Russia. So Russia is now seen as an East Asian nation, not just a European or Eurasian nation, but also an East Asian nation. We don't know what specific agendas will develop over time out of this East Asian summit, but it does indicate to us that there is a struggle going on in the region as to whether to push the Asian side of the regional integration to the forefront, similar to the kind of proposal that Mahathir used to make, that Asian community for Asians only kind of approach, on the one hand, and on the other, Pan-Pacific community building, including the United States and possibly even Canada, and some of the not-so-Asian but Asia-located countries like Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. Another interesting development that has a profound region-wide impact is the ASEAN, I mentioned, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. ASEAN, over many decades, it came into existence in 1967, but over the decades, it has evolved into a fairly effective dialogue framework for all the countries in Southeast Asia, plus the partner countries, dialogue partners, as I mentioned, China, Japan, and South Korea. And now, in addition, you have Russia and the United States participating in some of the dialogues along with the ASEAN members. But ASEAN has been relatively successful in developing itself as a fairly coherent organization in Southeast Asia with increasingly broader scope of issues to cover the entire Pacific, based on what is known as the ASEAN way, which means decisions are made on the basis of consensus. So one country can veto any progress in the dialogue on economic, political, or security fronts. But in order for the ASEAN members to maintain their coherence, they intentionally decided not to bring in any hardcore security, controversial security issues onto their agenda. Because if they had, the ASEAN probably would have crumbled. But while they were preventing those important issues from being placed on the agenda, they were able to solidify their consensus-based decision-making, and they see each other as members of a future community. And in fact, in the year 2015, they're supposed to establish an ASEAN community made up of political community, security community, and social cultural community. Security community in the sense that no country within ASEAN membership contemplates on fighting a war against any other member in the region. And there's no significant preparation for war among the countries of the region. This is a remarkable achievement. But, as I said, ASEAN way has been facilitating this ASEAN approach to, if you will, conflict resolution by not allowing major conflict issues onto the agenda. I have serious doubts as to how this can continue when China, the United States, also become part of an extended dialogue forum. Because these big powers have their own security concerns and strategic interests that are likely to influence their position on specific issues within ASEAN. A case in point is the territorial disputes in the South China Sea. You've heard quite a bit about China and Vietnam, the Philippines, and several other countries having disputes in the South China Sea. And the United States and Japan have expressed deep concern about what seems to be gradually expanding parameters of the Chinese military presence, naval presence there. And they usually refer to the idea of freedom of navigation. They say international freedom of navigation should be protected by the international community, not by any one particular country, especially when that country is not us, if it's somebody else. Right? China vehemently opposed such an approach, saying we are simply trying to control our own territories, which any sovereign state is entitled to do. So there is a deep division of opinion and approach as to how to resolve these territorial disputes in South China Sea in such a way that they can be peacefully resolved without disrupting international shipping, which is crucial for the survival of the economies of Northeast Asia and, of course, Southeast Asia. Another very important principle on which the ASEAN way has evolved is the principle of equality, non-intervention, and peaceful resolution of conflicts. When it comes to sovereignty issues, such as disputes over territories, the very fact that somebody else claims your territory or the territory that you think is yours is intervention. So how do you reconcile this principle of non-intervention into the internal affairs of their countries in the region, on the one hand, and the fact that claims overlap and compete and conflict? And if you can help the Chinese and the Vietnamese and the Filipinos and others resolve these issues, you'll win a Nobel Peace Prize. And the same applies for you who are interested in territorial disputes between China and Japan, between South Korea and Japan, and between Russia and Japan, all of which are legacies of the history of pre-war and wartime Japanese actions. Let's turn our attention quickly to what has been going on inside Japan. I don't want to give you a whole introduction to Japanese politics or economics or society. My intent is simply to highlight the difficult struggle that Japan is involved in domestically, which prevents Japan from playing the kind of international role that I think it ought to play in the region and beyond the region. The first thing that you notice is the very, very sluggish economic growth of Japan. It has been growing, but at the annual rate of between 0.5 and 2.0% over the last two decades. Japan's GDP grew at the annualized rate of 6% in the last quarter ending in September, but next quarter is expected to be much, much, much slower. So that Japan will achieve something like 2.3% growth over the last entire year. In contrast to China, which continues to grow at the annual rate of between 9 and 11%. And China, as I said earlier, has already overtaken Japan in terms of the size of GDP. There are other domestic problems in Japan besides economic performance, but which also have a major impact on its economic growth. One is the demographic decline. Japanese population simply is shrinking. It started declining in 2005 for the first time since 1945. And why is that? Well, low fertility. Young generations don't want to get married until 28, 29, 30, 31. Some women don't want to get married, period. And that is now accepted, not as a norm, but as certainly within the range of normal behavior. One of the major reasons why people are either postponing marriage or deciding not to get married is the cost of living and cost of bringing up children and family in Japan now. In large part because of the sluggish economic performance of the country over the last two decades. The population is aging very fast. By 2025, they say about one-third of Japanese population would be 65 years old or older. And their welfare will have to be supported by shrinking younger segments of the Japanese population. So if Japan can somehow overcome this difficulty of supporting increasingly larger and aged population by the working energies and hours and talents of the shrinking segment of the population, they will collectively win the Nobel Peace Prize because other countries are right behind Japan in terms of these trends, including, surprisingly, China. In the next 20 to 30 years, Chinese population will peak and it will begin to decline. But already China has a very different kind of demographic problem from most of the other countries, and it's called the gender imbalance. Right? Mao Rong was telling me yesterday that more than one out of 10 males in China cannot find a mate, statistically speaking anyway, unless they change their marriage culture so that the one, you know, person can marry several people of the opposite gender, but that's not going to happen in China for sure. So these demographic issues are seriously challenging the ability of the economies of East Asia, and I would say South Korea as well, in managing their economy, maintaining their living standard of living, and somehow keeping their household and nation's cohesive holds. And then there's the political malaise. Well, I would say political malady in Japan. Six prime ministers in 6 years. That's unheard of. You think in the U.S. presidential elections, you know, you become a president, and almost as soon as you get elected as a president, you sort of start the campaign for the next cycle. But in Japan, a prime minister has served only 1 year or 1 year and 2 months out of 6 years among the last six prime ministers. So when does one have time to invest his talent, his political capital, in new initiatives to change the economic landscape in Japan in time to see effects of his efforts? You don't. So how do you manage Japanese economy when the leadership changes, you know, almost overnight and very frequently? Let's talk a little bit about the what I call 3-11. We have our 9-11, they have their 3-11. A traumatic experience for the Japanese, to say the least. Several effects can be observed, one of which is the public confidence in government disappearing, deeply shaken, because the Japanese public had been led to believe that the Japanese technology is so superb, including nuclear technology, that it's safe, that it's productive, that it keeps Japanese economy going forward. But as a result of the tsunami which hit the Fukushima nuclear plant, number one nuclear plant, there was a meltdown, which was admitted much, much later on than American scientists had suggested, almost 2 days after March 11th. It shook the Japanese public's confidence in both the ability of the industry and the government to keep their homes safe. It also diminished Japanese public's confidence in the ability of the government to communicate with the public. But if you look at Japan from outside through the visual media, you come pretty impressed, wouldn't you say, by the way the Japanese public have conducted themselves in the middle of the crisis, people standing in lines waiting for bottles of water. Wonder what would happen if you went through something similar in Omaha. Certainly in Washington, D.C. or New York, you wouldn't see people standing patiently for hours in line waiting for bottles of water. But this incident did tarnish Japan's image as a secure and safe nation with impeccable civilian technology. And the lasting effect on the nuclear technology, nuclear energy in Japan, is another thing that I'd like to just briefly touch upon. Germany, under Merkel, was really amazing, right? 1 or 2 days after the Japanese had undergone this experience with a nuclear reactor accident, the German government said, we're going to stop our dependence on nuclear technology for its energy needs in the future. Japan moves very slow. We were talking about that over lunch with some colleagues. Public opinion is clearly in favor of discontinuing all the nuclear plants around the country. But the industry has convinced them that's impossible, that at least 15 or 16 nuclear reactors that are now operating, after they have passed the safety checks, should be should be brought back online and continue to supply Japanese industry and commercial and residential households well supplied with energy. Although a growing number of people are saying we should look into alternative technologies right, such as wind technology, solar technology, and so on and so forth. And hydroelectricity, which used to be the only source of major source of energy for Japan in the immediate post-war period, in addition to coal, is now being looked into as a possible alternative source of energy as well. But nothing can quickly replace the energy that is currently being supplied by nuclear technology. But I would suppose that in the next 5 to 10 years, about half of the 15 or so nuclear reactors that are now operating will stop and will not be resuming the operation. So eventually, Japanese nuclear industry will die a very slow death. But in the meantime, the Japanese government and the industry are advocating export of Japanese nuclear technology to other countries because they have invested such a huge amount of human and material resources in the development of nuclear technology. They don't want to see it all go to waste. So they want to make some profits and then use some of those profits in developing alternative sources of energy. In terms of the impact of 311 on Japan's relationship with the United States, Russia, South Korea, and China, all these countries offered humanitarian assistance. Very clear, no question about it. Russia provided the largest rescuer team of all the countries. But they came and returned fairly quickly. In contrast, the United States, which has initiated the Operation Tomodachi, has stayed on in Japan, involving not only civilians, but also the military personnel, in providing assistance, humanitarian rescue, and also humanitarian goods delivery to the people who need it. And I think U.S. assistance to Japan has had a far more favorable impact on the public perception about the willingness of the international community to assist Japan in time of crisis than any of the other countries that I just mentioned, which have also offered some material and humanitarian assistance. The relationship between China and Japan, as I said earlier, is very sensitive, and this sensitivity of the bilateral relationship was reflected in the fact that Hu Jintao, when he was giving his annual speech last year, spent more than 2 hours talking about the achievements, you know, of his government, particularly with a great emphasis on the continued sustained economic growth. Only in the last sentence or two did he mention the fact that Japan had just suffered this devastating earthquake, tsunami, and now a nuclear reactor accident. I don't think Hu Jintao decided to belittle the suffering of the Japanese people, but he did not want to put a premium or highlight on this particular incident in the middle of his annual speech. And some of us interpret this as an indication of the difficulty with which the Chinese leadership have to deal when it comes to issues related to Japan, good or bad. In South Korea, NGOs raised millions of dollars, voluntary contributions to Japan, within a few days of 311. But then when they heard that the Japanese government was about to approve the publication of a series of high school textbooks that clearly indicated that the Tokto, which Japanese call the island Takeshima, belong to Japan, the contributions plummeted immediately. So that again tells us something about the nature of the bilateral relationship between South Korea and Japan. There is humanitarian sentiment, no question about it, among the South Korean people vis-a-vis the Japanese victims of this natural and not so natural crisis. but also the political sentiment. The wind of political sentiment can shift direction immediately. So lasting effects of the previous history continue to prevent full reconciliation and full accommodation of mutual interests and concerns across national borders in East Asia. Let me just mention Russia, a country I love, a country I've visited more than 15 times, continues to deal with the so-called Northern Territories territorial dispute with Japan as though these days those disputes, that dispute no longer exists. These are small islands off the coast of Hokkaido, the northernmost of the Japanese islands, that the Soviet troops occupied in the waning days of the Second World War, forcing all Japanese to evacuate. And so there's not one Japanese citizen living on these islands. But the Japanese insist that these islands belong to Japan because the Soviet Union did not sign the San Francisco Peace Treaty, in which Japan surrendered islands that they had obtained through greed and war and aggression. The Japanese did not win these islands through war and aggression, and Russia did not sign, the Soviet Union, the predecessor of the Russian government, did not sign this treaty. So according to the Japanese, it's legitimately to be claimed that these islands belong to Japan, and the Russian occupation of those islands is unjust and illegal, and so forth. But just a few days after the Japanese disaster, President Medvedev actually went to visit one of these islands. And after he left the island, Japanese Prime Minister Khan said, this is intolerable. A president of another country comes to our territory without our permission. And then the foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, says, Japan has no business telling the Russian president where to go within his own territory. So this stalemate continues to this day. So you would think that in the 21st century, you would have outgrown the impacts of the Second World War or even pre-war legacies. But no, these legacies continue to this day. So under these circumstances, what can we hope to achieve in terms of resolving these some of these issues? I think it boils down to our need to educate younger generations who can crisscross the globe, if not, you know, physically, mentally, through visual media, through internet communications, and so forth. A very popular Japanese group of musicians went to Beijing just last month. And they were loved by young Chinese who have been listening to their music for over a decade and wanting to hear them face-to-face in Beijing. And this is, sort of symbolizes the sentiment of younger generations that really want to come together and enjoy what life has to offer without being hampered by the legacy of history. But the same young people, if they're asked to comment on Japan's wartime atrocities, they'll be just as vehement as their parents, the grandparents, who suffered at the hands of the Japanese invading forces in the 1930s and 40s. But if you allow the past to keep you hostage, you will not be able to move into the future. But I do understand that the sentiment that the Chinese, South Koreans, and North Koreans feel about their parents or grandparents suffering at the hands of the Japanese must somehow be dealt with squarely by the Japanese government. But also, those countries should recognize that Japan has not invaded one single country since 1945, Japan has not even had an intent to launch any weapons beyond its national borders against anybody. So Japan is an entirely different country. But when you have a government, at least managed, if not totally controlled, media in China, for example, telling the public one thing or another about the atrocious Japanese of the past, it does color Chinese perception of Japan, just as when a handful of Japanese nationalists in Japan monopolize on the public debate on the future relationship between Japan and China and paint a very, very dark picture for China, it does affect the Japanese public perception of China. So what is necessary is democratization in China, further democratization in Japan, and improved communication between the two nations, particularly among the younger generations, so they will see each other with their own eyes. They taste their mutual, they taste their music, arts, and so forth with their own senses, rather than relying, depending for their future upon what's written in the textbook or other commentaries. So it may be a very commonsensical recommendation that public education is extremely important for young generations, but that's the foundation upon which we can build a true East Asia community. And I do hope that China and the United States will be able to manage their differences in the future, because after all, being Japanese, I deeply care about the future of Japan, and Japan's political and security relationship with the United States is essential for its survival, for its stability, for its and prosperity. But China's economic development and further stability is also essential to Japan's prosperity and stability as well. So Japan needs both the United States and China. So it's up to you to convince the U.S. government that multilateralism is a good thing, that the United States should engage both Japan and China, not as an enemy or adversary, pushing them into a corner, but rather getting them out of the corner into the global diplomatic, political, economic, and cultural sphere, so that the Chinese will be able to enjoy the freedom of traveling around the world as freely as we, the Japanese, or you, the Americans, have been able to do for generations now. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Tsuneo Akaha, Professor of International Policy Studies and Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He spoke on the topic, Old and New Conflicts, Japan and the Great Powers. Mr. Akaha's appearance was co-sponsored by Creighton University's Asian World Center, the Werner Institute for Negotiation and Dispute Resolution, and the Department of Political Science and International Relations in the College of Arts and Sciences. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, November 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Dr. Maorang Jiang, Director of Creighton's Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.